It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll meet a woman from Uganda who's helping the former captives of Joseph Kony find healing and hope.
First, this week is Sunshine Week, a nationally recognized week meant to highlight the need for government transparency. Governor Scott Walker got Sunshine Week off to an early start with an executive order issued Friday relating to open records requests.
Bill Leaders is with us now to talk about the executive order and to give his take. He's president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. Bill, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here, Rob.
Well, what was included in this executive order from the governor on Friday?
It did several things. Ordered that people within state government agencies receive training in open government laws, open records laws in particular. It would establish a tracking system for each agency within state government so that they keep track of when requests come in and how quickly they are processed. It require agencies to work with the Department of Administration to assess their performance, again, with an eye toward improving it over time. And it sets some very firm deadlines for responding to records requests. It says that state agencies should be acknowledging the receipt of a request within one day. They should be fulfilling simple records requests within 10 business days. And that whenever a citizen, a requester, writes and wants a update as to the status of his or her request, that they should receive an answer to that within 5 business days. None of these things are set in stone in the statute. Some of them have been part of what has been recommended by, like, the Attorney General's office. But this here sets forth to state employees, this is what you should do. These are the guidelines that you should meet in terms of time.
And does this executive order give any indication of how this will be followed through on to make sure that it's not just a one-and-done deal, but that somebody's going to be watching to make sure these guidelines are followed?
Well, there's the two things. It's the tracking mechanism that they're supposed to create that will, you know, ironically create a record that people like me can check to see just what their performance is and how many requests they receive, how quickly they respond to them. That's a great idea.
So that's an open record of the open record, in effect.
Correct, yes. And it does say that you need to work with our Department of Administration to look at ways that you can improve. I think if you have that mindset, how do we do this? How can we do it better? It's just a great thing. It will lead for people within agencies to suggest opportunities for improving their response to records requests. One thing that they say in these new guidelines in the executive order is it encourages people within state government to go back to the requester to seek clarification. That's something that, you know, we've encouraged at the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, both of requesters and custodians, you know, invite a dialogue. Sometimes the reason it takes so long, sometimes the reason people aren't satisfied with the result is that there's miscommunication between the two sides. So, you know, reach out and have a conversation. What is it you want? How can we get it to you? That's another good thing in this package of initiatives.
Now, you're someone who has kind of been on the other side of arguments with this governor and governors past, with lawmakers, I think, from both parties on open records. How do you feel about what the governor has called for here?
This is one of the most positive things I've seen happen in the state of Wisconsin from the executive branch. That's not to say that everything that Scott Walker has done in the past has been bad. There are some issues where we still disagree with the interpretations that the Walker administration are embracing in order to withhold and deny access to records. But this is a very positive step. I mean, it basically has raised the expectations for state agencies in terms of their compliance with the open records law. It says this matters and we expect you to do a good job of it. I think this will improve record access in the state of Wisconsin.
Talking to Bill Leaders with the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council about a new executive order for the governor on government transparency on open records. Bill, this happened just before Sunshine Week this week. Talk about how important open records are. Let's start with for the press and the media's ability to cover what our government is doing.
Oh, sure. There's all kinds of stories where having access to the underlying documents, you know, allows a story to be told or brings new information to light. Media use it all the time. But in fact, media are a minority of the users of our open records law. The vast majority of users are businesses and ordinary citizens, businesses who seek certain information that's useful to into what they do, and then citizens who have a particular interest in a topic, like parents who care about school issues will request records from a school district in order to be better informed. The majority of requests are not coming from media, but are coming from ordinary citizens who want information for, you know, because they care about an issue, or because knowing that information can help them do their business function better.
One concern I've heard over the years from people in government is sometimes that, okay, open records are good, they provide a service, but they can be overwhelming to a government office. They might not have the resources, the person power to handle these, and there can be nuisance open records efforts that can flood a lawmaker's office or a state department, things like that. Is that a worry for you?
Well, I've seen a very few instances of what I would consider nuisance requests, where someone keeps asking for everything under the sun because they're angry at a public official. That is not common. That is not something that happens often. And I do think that the important threshold is set here by our open records law itself, which states in its declaration of purpose that providing records is deemed to be one of the most important functions of people who work for government, and that it has to take priority over other things. And so when they say, oh, we don't have the resources to deal with it, my answer is, well, then allocate those resources, because the law tells you you need to take this seriously. And now Governor Walker is telling them that, too.
There was some criticism earlier this year of Governor Walker and some of the legislature trying to keep records that they deem transitory or part of the deliberative process out of open records. The argument there being we need to be able to sort out some details, maybe discard the bad ideas, and then we start drafting the legislation for real. How did you see all that resolved?
Oh, that's one of the things I referred to earlier. It's a terrible exemption to seek to have, to say that anything that we do while we're trying to decide, while we're crafting law or policy, we should be able to suppress that, keep that secret. That would create just a huge black hole into which public officials can throw literally anything they want, because once it's secret, it's secret. You don't know what they're hiding. And I do not know that there's any burning reason that government officials need greater secrecy when it comes to the deliberations that they have over the crafting of law or policy. I've seen a good deal of these materials as a reporter, and I'll tell you, I have a lot more respect for the people who run government than the ordinary citizen does, because I have seen these records, and I do see how seriously they take their job and how well they do it most of the time. So, yeah, I'm just baffled by their determination to pass through this exemption. It's not in their own interest, and it's certainly not in the interest of the people in the state of Wisconsin. And I hope Governor Walker can see clear through to a different way of looking at this.
Very briefly before we wrap up, Bill, do you see this as part of momentum toward more open government in the state?
It's hard to say. I don't see the legislature's leadership at the moment doing anything to improve its record in terms of open government. I think there's some people high up within the legislature who are fairly hostile to the notion that the public should be able to see what they're doing. And I expect there to be additional future attempts to cut away at access. That's one of the reasons we're doing this traveling show. Beginning tomorrow, we're going to 8 cities across the state of Wisconsin. People can look at our website for more particular information, but we are going to La Crosse and Eau Claire, Wausau and Green Bay and Sheboygan.
And we'll hear more about that tomorrow, thanks to Bill Leaders with Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. Sister Rosemary Nyarumbe is part of an effort called Sewing Hope. She believes she's doing more than teaching girls to sew. She's helping them stitch their lives back together. Sister Nyarumbe is a Catholic nun and humanitarian who's dedicated her life to helping girls held captive by the warlord Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda. She runs 2 schools there where the girls are taught to make purses out of the pull tabs on soda cans and other training to help them earn a living as they heal.
Sister Rosemary Nyarumbe has been named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People, and her work can be seen in the documentary Sewing Hope on Netflix and online at sewinghope.com. She's speaking tonight in Madison at 7:30 at the Overture Center. Sister Rosemary, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, can you tell us how you first got started helping children, girls who were former captives of Joseph Kony?
It was a long process of thinking of what to do next in a very difficult situation, because I personally came from northern Uganda, and that's where I was brought up. And the war started just when I knew all about it. And all my life I experienced the different wars in Uganda. But this one was the worst one so far, because the rebels really turned all their target towards women and children. And that is really what I saw was very bad. And it was for me like women were used as a weapon of war, and children very young were also used as sex slaves. And the Lord's Resistance Army actually evolved from Holy Spirit movement, which was started by a woman. And when the woman went away, Alice Lakwena, who was a cousin to Joseph Kony, who is the current leader of the Lord's Resistance Army Rebel, he took over, and they started targeting women and children, especially abducting young ones in order to increase their army. And this is when the rebels became very, very infamous, as first of all, they thought they were fighting an existing government. But of course, to fight a government, you would not target women and children. And that's how they became very, very infamous. Once they abducted these children, they would take them in unknown destinations, especially South Sudan or other places. And the women would be used as sex slaves. Even children, very young, especially girls, they were more prized by these rebels. And the women and children went through a very, very painful situation. And some of them managed to escape to come back to their home country. And, of course, when the children managed to come back, the society was scared of them. They were afraid of them because they were all known as murderers or children who were brainwashed or trained to kill, because the rebels used kind of tactics of abducting these children and bringing them back to their communities and forcing them to commit atrocities. And in that case, people really looked at these children as potential killers and murderers, and everybody was scared of them. This is exactly the situation where I started operating. I sent a radio announcement because I knew some of these young women were by themselves in town. I did not know where they could go. People were afraid of them. I invited them. I said, come to St. Monica, to the school we are running. And I actually did invite them to come to school. I was giving them a kind of home atmosphere, a family where they were accepted, where they could again rebuild their broken lives.
So the Lord's Resistance Army had abducted women, children, and when they returned, it sounds like you were there for them. Can you give me a sense of how many of these former captives you were working with and how many there were?
No, up to now, I should talk of 2,000 children or women so far, because the number kept on increasing and increasing. And it's so, so difficult to keep track of everybody who passed through that center, because we really let it open to come for people to come in. Even children who are running away from their families, from the communities, children who are known as night commuters. And actually the international community knew them as invisible children. We had a lot of these children come to hide in our school. Every day we would house like 500 children hiding from the Lord's Resistance Army, because they would go to villages and abduct these kids. So these children would walk long distances to look for safe places. And one of the places where they were hiding was, again, St. Monica.
Can you tell us about some of them? Some of them, it sounds like that there were just so many of them that they came and went. But can you tell us about some of the stories, the people that you met, and what they told you about what they'd been through?
You know, I meet so many of these children, young women, up to today. And, of course, before coming here, I met one woman who was with me for a long time. And after she went out and settled by herself, Victoria by name, this girl was abducted from a very far place, not even in Gulu itself. And she was abducted from another tribe. And later on, she was forced to learn the language of the rebels. And she was trained as a soldier. She was used as sex slaves. And later she became pregnant and got a child from one of the rebel commanders. But this girl narrated her story. She said when she gave birth by herself, a very young girl at the age about 16, she gave birth, and she had nobody to help her to take care of her child. She said she felt her baby would die, but she didn't like to part with the baby. And she managed to escape with a one-week-old baby. She carried the baby on her back and held a gun in her hand, and she escaped. And she said the gun was to protect her from anybody who would intimidate her on the way. And actually, she told me when she crossed into Uganda from the Sudan, the people she met were Uganda army, the soldiers from Uganda government, and they commanded her to come to them. And she said, I commanded them to put down their guns before I could go to them. And so they respected her, put down their guns, and then she walked to them and handed the gun. And this girl was brought in a rehabilitation center very far away from Gulu itself. And I was invited to go and pick up one boy who was abducted from our orphanage. We had 26 children abducted one time from our orphanage. And so I was told one of the kids, a boy, was in that rehabilitation center. When I went, I found this boy. I was speaking with him in his language, which is totally different from the language spoken in that area. And so this young woman had me speaking that language, which was also her language. She came by and said, sister, I also speak that same language. I was abducted some many years, and can you take me with you? I was so moved to see how miserable this girl was. And she told me, I have a baby of 1 week old. Can I come with the baby? I said, yes, you can come with the baby. I took her in, and this boy, and this was way back in 2005. And this woman was with me all the time. We took care of the child. We brought up the woman herself. We trained her, gave her some skills. And later on, she decided that she was going out to try to settle on her own and look after her children, which I thought was quite good. It was a good sign that she was getting over her pain. But I kept on following her, and I realized that this girl still lacks something. She didn't have education. She has no means of supporting herself and her children. And so we decided to help her with the skills we gave her, like making purses, making beads, to sell and get some money. Still, it was not enough. She decided to get married to somebody. And I had told her before getting married, I said, you do know that your marriage is going to be temporary. First of all, get married to the skills we're giving you, because this is the way you will support your children in future. And so this girl understood this. After a short, I think about only 5 years, she went on with the man she married a second time, and the marriage broke. This girl started going through a lot of suffering with the children, the two children she got from, the first one from the rebel, the second one she got when she came out. And so this woman keeps coming back to me. And just before coming here, she came back to me asking me, sister, I know I'm trying my best to support my children, but I'm not able to continue paying the school fees for two of them, which I totally understood. And I told her, I say, who are you not able to pay for? She said, the first baby. And of course, that one has no father. The father was one of the rebels. She was actually forced into sex to get this baby. And so I told her, I said, bring back, that's my baby. I'll take care of her. And so I sent the girl back to school in order to give support to this woman and also to relieve her.
Sister Rosemary Nirumbe is a nun from Uganda who works with children who are former captives of the warlord Joseph Kony. And you've gotten attention around the world for what you've done, the stories that you just described there. You're teaching these women, these girls and children skills so that they have a trade, that when they come back and they start to maybe recover and move forward with their lives, that they have a way to make money. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about Sewing for Hope.
You know, one thing which I always want people to know is that when these young women come back home, everybody looks at them like trash. They don't consider them worthy of even anything. And so I try my best to make them understand that we are going to rebuild their lives, but they must take it. They must be able to cooperate with us, because I see clearly that their destiny is in their own hands. That's why I emphasize practical skills, because I know they did not go far with their education, and there would be nothing much we could teach them except practical skills. And that's how I tried my best to look for all ways. And when we started making purses, collecting pop tabs and making beautiful purses from these purses.
From the tabs on pop cans.
Yes, I actually have them. And we sell to people. The money goes back to these women. But what I tell people clearly that the pop tab purses are very significant of women sewing back their brokenness.
Mm.
Because we are collecting trash and putting this trash to become beautiful. And these women are also considered as trash in the eyes of many people. And walking through them and getting them to bring back their dignity by working together, I think is a great significant that we could use the analogy of a needle. We say a needle can mend broken pieces, put them together, like any cloth you would put on, even if it's a rug. If you mend them, they would look beautiful. And I totally look at these young women as rugs, as people who could be mended. And that's why I tell them, make sure the trash we are having is going to be your triumph. We are going to move from trash to treasure. That's why I very much value every trash I find, and especially the pop tabs, which can be used to signify these women.
Sister Rosemary, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sister Rosemary Nyerumbe is a Catholic nun and humanitarian from Uganda. You can find more about her work at sewinghope.com. She's speaking tonight at 7:30 p.m. at Madison's Overture Center.
Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The days of a husband and father supporting his family with just his paycheck are long gone. More women are graduating from college than men, and gender roles are seeing a major shift.
In short, our next guest says it looks like the age of the dominant male is over. He says that's probably a good thing overall, but it leaves men with an uncertain future. Jack Myers joins us now. He's the founder of MediaVillage.com. He's the author of the new book, Future of Men, Masculinity in the 21st Century. Jack, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob and Veronica.
Why do you see this as such a turning point for the future of men and boys, this dramatic shift you're talking about?
The shift has been happening for many years, and essentially what we're seeing are the positive results from 60-plus years of the women's movement, but we're also seeing some major shifts in education and in the economy that are impacting on relationships. But if we start with education, for the past decade and for into the foreseeable future, about 60% of college grads are women. They're not only moving into the workplace, but young women under 30 are out earning young men nationally by about 8% and as much as 20% in some major cities. We're seeing women, couples getting married later, and because the women are out earning the men, they're more likely to stay in the workplace and moving up through the corporate hierarchy. 13 of the top 15 growth industries are dominated by women in the junior and middle management ranks, as much as 60-70%. So education feeds into the workplace, and then we're seeing implications across all aspects of society that really lead to a very fundamental conclusion that the thousands of years of male dominance are being transformed into a future where women will be more dominant and more prominent.
And you say that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it requires some adjustments from men who may or may not expect to be in that dominant role as they grow up. So how is that playing out in men's daily lives?
Well, realistically, we have to recognize that the women's movement will continue to be successful, and it's important to continue to support the women's movement. The men still have a lock on the C-suite, and we need to, you know, really support more women moving up into the C-suite, into board positions, and toward overall pay equality. But the reality is that women have a tremendous amount of support as women join corporations, companies, organizations. There are typically women's groups. There are women's mentoring organizations. There are women-to-women initiatives. And women, frankly, talk to each other about their needs, their realities, their lives more than men do. But there are very few, if any, support groups for men coming into companies, into organizations. There is no organized way for men to get mentoring, to get have guides, to have support. So they're feeling lost, feeling left behind. As we encourage women to lean in, we're also at the same time seem to be creating a lean-out generation of young men who are feeling disenfranchised, disaffected, and in many ways feeling confronted and challenged by the realities they're facing and don't know which way to turn.
Well, one response has been, and people have been writing about this for a couple decades now, a backlash against women in these new roles, and that hasn't changed now. You see news stories all the time about women facing discrimination or sexual harassment in high-paying tech jobs, in academia, active attempts to harass women online via social media, things like that. That is a response. What do you make of that response to this changing landscape?
Well, and we're certainly seeing some of that in politics today as well, the backlash. And that's exactly the issue that I focus on, is that because we're not building into our support initiatives for women an equivalent support focus on men, men are feeling left out, men are feeling unengaged, and that they have nowhere to turn. So they are, we are feeding into a backlash, a hostility, an online effort to engage these men, whether it's for financial gain through several of these anti-female organizations, for political gain, or for any other reason. We're finding more focus on how we create anger than how we create success and engagement.
Talking to Jack Myers, author of the new book, The Future of Men, Masculinity in the 21st Century. Jack, you, through a lot of your book, talk about what you see as more positive responses to what you see as the end of male dominance in our culture. What would you recommend, say, younger men especially, as they enter this world?
Well, first of all, I think many, many younger men are already there. They've grown up in an environment at school, in college, where girls are dominant and prominent. 60% in colleges are female. Their teachers have been heavily female. More than 40% of children today are growing up in fatherless homes, so they have women as role models. And we're seeing among young men more and more who have many of the qualities that the women's movement would like men to have: more vulnerable, more emotionally open, more sensitive, more honest, less focused on being strong, on being dominant, on being the provider, more open to being a stay-at-home dad, more open to being supportive of their wives with housework and child care. So number one is to reinforce and support them societally. When you meet a man who's a stay-at-home dad, to embrace him, to encourage him, to support him, instead of the responses many of them get, which, oh, you couldn't get a job. Recognize and understand that young men are caught in the crosshairs of a generational shift. I create an analogy to they're moving from the driver's seat to the passenger seat. And when they were driving, even if they didn't have the directions, they're in control and didn't need to ask. And, you know, we know men don't ask for directions. But there's really no GPS for relationships, and they're not in control anymore. So I think it's really important for women to recognize what men are confronting, to give them guidance, to support them, to engage them in conversations, to encourage them, to be more emotionally open. I also think that we need job training. We need more focus on creating jobs that for young men and support for young men who want to go into what I call the HEAL careers, the health, education, administrative, and literacy careers. We're supporting women in the STEM careers. We need to support young men going into the HEAL careers. We need a redesign of our educational system that to make sure it's more supportive for young men today as it has been for women. That means more gaming, reintroduce physical education and recess into the curriculum, create more programs in the high schools around education, training for health careers, for administrative careers that we encourage young men and boys to go into. And really, in the political spectrum, we really need to put an end to this, to these anti-female initiatives that foster anger and a sense of either or, that it's them or us, male, female, and really create more of a gender neutrality.
Well, Jack, I want to jump in and bring this into pop culture. You write about that some in the book. It seems like so many TV shows, advertisements, too, are really playing on or playing with this anxiety. When you think of shows like Scrubs or Modern Family, this clash between often the man of the old school, the stereotypical traditional male, and the younger generation who's playing around with those gender roles, and sometimes that's seen as a positive, sometimes as being policed out of them. What do you make of that?
Oh, my God, Rob, you're so on target there. That it's not just the TV programs where we've had 180 or so programs in the last 40 years that focus on single dads and less than a handful that focus on single moms, yet 40% of kids are growing up in single mom homes. Commercials, I think we really have to change the narrative. And just as we focused on ending objectification of women in TV commercials, we really have to look at the way men are portrayed in TV commercials today. We've got the beer commercials where men are misogynist and sexist at the bar being served by gorgeous women hanging out with each other. We've got the man as idiot in commercials where they can't pick out their own analgesic or know how to diaper a baby or clean up a spill without the help of the woman. We've really got to pay attention to the way men are personified. And think about the young men who have grown up with commercials for sexual dysfunction their whole lives, and they look, and that's their image of what a man is today. A buffoon like Homer Simpson or Peter Griffin of the Family Guy, an idiot from commercials, a sexist, a misogynist, or all at the same time being sexually dysfunctional. So we've really got to look at the narrative around how we portray men and relationships in media and in commercials.
We're talking to Jack Myers, author of the new book, The Future of Men, looking at the changing role of masculinity, and you can join the conversation.
Have you noticed your own role changing at work or at home and getting away from more traditional masculine stereotypes? Is it a good thing that masculinity seems like it might be getting an update? And how do you think men can better adjust to these changing gender roles? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're continuing our conversation about the changing concept of masculinity, and we want to hear from you.
Have you noticed the roles of men and women changing in recent years? How is that affecting your life at home, at work? Is this a positive change? Can it be? And what do you think about what our guest had to say about how men are portrayed in popular culture? Do you see positive role models out there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Jack Myers is with us. His new book is The Future of Men, Masculinity in the 21st Century. I want to talk about the whole role of man as the provider, Jack, and that's something that seems to be part of this anxiety, too. The idea that, if you look back at the 50s, the guy with the job could maintain a whole family, and now that's not really a reality for most people. Do you think that's part of the anxiety and the uncertainty you're writing about?
Certainly is, Rob, and most families now, first of all, need a two two-person income in order to just get through their monthly bills and needs. So with both people working, the question then becomes who has the greater income. With more and more women in roles that not only are out earning their men but have greater earning potential, more and more men are taking somewhat of a back seat in their role, and they're really not societally prepared for it or accepted. That's it's not embraced. We're going through this massive transformation, and with any disruption and transformation, there is discomfort and concern. So I think we really need to accept that this is happening. We need to embrace it more. There needs to be more media coverage of it. We are constantly exposed in the media, in the newspapers, in op-eds, editorials, and books and magazine stories and TV reports about the advances of women and the concerns and the issues related to women's rights, women's equality, but we very rarely read about or hear about what's going on in men and what we need to do to support men. What I find, one of the statistics that just astounded me is that 85% of heterosexual long-term relationships that end are ended by the woman. And I spend a lot of time in the book talking about the changes in relationships, the changes in dating, online dating, the dynamics taking place in relationships. But what's happened is women are taking more and more control over their relationships. They're, because they're economically less dependent on the men, because regulatory environment, and the emotional realities have changed dramatically. Women are increasingly dissatisfied in their relationships, and a lot of that is because the men are not educationally their equals, or and because the men are not responding positively and well to the changes taking place in the household. They're still looking to have control and to do less housework, less childcare, and frankly, women are standing up more and saying, no, this is not acceptable. And as a result, we're seeing among middle-aged women, we see three times as many single middle-aged women as there were just a few decades ago.
Let's go to our callers at 800-642-1234. Todd is with us now in Appleton. Todd, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I was calling in reference to a lot of the young men growing up in single-parent families, primarily with the mom raising them. And I have seen this socially. I go to a coffee shop a lot and talk with all different people from all different ages, and I kind of enjoy that. But I've noticed, not to stereotype folks, but I think there's a lot of young men that seem to not have a lot of male role models in their life as they grow old, and how to treat women, how to act socially. They're kind of buried in their iPhones and not really responding socially. And a lot of the ladies I talk to say that's one of their complaints, is that they just seem to be disconnected and kind of live in their own little world.
Todd, thanks a lot for that call. And Jack, at some point in your book, you mentioned you think that parents should be careful to expose and make sure their sons see positive relationships, positive role models, even if that man isn't part of the relationship that's bringing them up.
Todd, I don't know whether you've had a chance to see the movie The Intern with Anne Hathaway and Robert De Niro, but that the very topic you're talking about is so well presented in that movie. And one of the lines, Anne Hathaway says, "When did girls become women and men become boys?" And Robert De Niro has a conversation with some of the young boys he's working with, and you know, he points out they're wearing T-shirts. They're not grooming well. They don't know how to be polite, how to open, how to express themselves. So even though women are looking for that independence and are gaining it and are looking for equality, that doesn't mean that you can't open the door for them. That doesn't mean that on the first date, at least, you can't offer to pay for the check or select the restaurant. And we need a return to these basic relationship rules that have been in place for so many years of just basic manners and basic gender recognition. It doesn't mean that it's not equal. It doesn't mean that you're giving something up to be, in a traditional sense, a man. But at the same time, young men don't have role models of positive influence, as you point out, Rob, and that's a real concern. But we need to differentiate between what the definitions that Todd is bringing forth about what works in a relationship and how men and women can interact, versus men being more accepting of women in roles that have been traditionally men's roles at work, in the family, and at school.
In our last minute or so, Jack, some advice to have a more positive future. As you said, it's not us against them for men and women. What should it look like?
Well, I really look at organizations and corporations because I focus on young men who are coming into the workforce. And I really think it's critically important that all of these mentoring organizations that have been created for women-to-women peer groups, that men begin to be embraced, young men begin to be embraced, and that we also do training for more senior men, men my age, men over 30, on what young men need. They don't need to be part of the old boys club, the old boys network. They really need to be understood for who they are and what their unique qualities are.
We'll leave it there. Jack, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me. I'd love to come back.
That's Jack Myers. He was with us to talk about changing gender roles. His latest book is The Future of Men, Masculinity in the 21st Century. You can still share your thoughts, by the way, over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Today is National Napping Day, scheduled for the day after we switch our clocks forward. No coincidence there. And Rob, you seem like you're kind of feeling the effects today.
I think I am. I don't know for sure if it's a lost hour or what, but yeah, I'm unusually sleepy today. I've talked to many others around the workplace who are too. So it makes it a good day for National Napping Day. I'd love to observe it. It's hard to find a time and place to nap here at WPR, though.
The thing is, we just don't have a culture where people nap.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
I really like the idea of the siesta culture.
Mm-hmm.
And would love to get that started here at Wisconsin Public Radio, but so far, no dice.
Yeah, also no hammocks.
I think
that would be a key first element here. I'm not going to sleep on the floor here. I don't know. It's just kind of gross.
Probably for the best.
To be honest, I'm not really a napping person. And I pretty much only nap if I'm like sick or completely sleepless or something. You?
Well, I could be convinced to nap almost for any reason at all.
You'll nap at the drop of a hat.
I'm usually a napper, yeah. And, you know, if you need any extra encouragement, by the way, there's lots of really cute pictures of animals napping on Twitter.
Twitter, we found them. And by the way, while you're at Twitter, if you could tear yourself away from the national, just look for the hashtag National Napping Day. I like bears and kittens napping. But also, tweet us, let us know if you are a napper. Tweet us at Central Time WPR.
And use the excuse, take a nap today.
Take a nap.
If you can pull it off, today's the day.
After Central Time is over. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.